Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Halberg, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome this morning to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, March 20th?
Wednesday.
Wednesday. Thank you. They need to actually write that down for me. Wednesday, March 20th. And we have four cases on our oral calendar this morning and one non-oral case. And so our first case this morning is A18-0773. And you both have 15 minutes for argument. Counsel for appellant, 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Why don't you go ahead and take the podium. And it adjusts up and down the podium as well as the microphone. And whenever you're ready, state your name and the party you represent for the record, please. And this is State versus Rawson.
Correct. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauk Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Jamie Rawson. We are here this morning at Mr. Hersey's request for oral argument on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Mr. Rawson has raised one issue for this court's consideration. That is whether the district court erred by admitting as relationship evidence under Minnesota Statute 634.20 the fact of Mr. Rawson's prior conviction. I believe this issue is fairly straightforward and presented adequately in my brief. I have just a few comments for this court this morning. The first is as to the standard of review.
Was prior conviction plus the sentence?
That is what the witness testified to, Your Honor. Yes. She says he was charged, convicted, and went to prison. This is not a plain error case. This issue was litigated. There was a ruling by the district court. Court's language is not always a model of clarity. However, we know the judge was ruling on 634.20. She references the statute in her ruling and says the conviction can come in. Testimony about the conviction can come in. Plain error is reserved for cases where there is no objection and the district court does not have an opportunity to rule. That is not where we are.
What do you think then the district court ruled specifically with respect to the relationship evidence and the conviction, that she could only testify to the conduct and if...
Not at all, Your Honor. I think by saying conviction, the judge was clearly saying the witness is also allowed to testify that he had a conviction. I believe the dispute between myself and the state is whether or not that by saying general and again, the judge was stating that the witness could only say he got a conviction, just a felony conviction, or whether, as my position is, she was allowing the witness to testify he had a second-degree assault conviction.
Do you think, but that's what I'm trying to, he did not, the defendant in this case did not testify.
Correct, Your Honor.
Correct? So there wasn't impeachment by a prior conviction.
True.
So what do you think that ruling meant with respect to when the testifying witness gets on the stand? What could she testify to under the court's ruling as you understood it?
That he had a prior second-degree assault conviction.
You think she could testify to that?
Yes. I think that's what the judge was allowing, and that is what we're asserting
was
error.
And so she could testify also to the... Oh, I'm sorry.
Was it error for her to testify or error for the trial court to allow her to testify in that way?
Error for the court to rule that she was permitted to testify as relationship evidence under 634.20 that he had a prior conviction about second-degree assault. She can testify to the facts. We do not dispute that.
Do you think that she could have been on there testifying to the facts and the district court said she can also testify he had a second-degree assault conviction?
That's absolutely what the court says.
Okay, so wouldn't that effectively be where we are, that she testifies to the facts of the assault and says, oh, and he had a second-degree assault conviction?
That is what happened.
Yeah, and so is the error?
So the error is
the court letting her add that?
Yes, so relationship evidence is domestic conduct, right? That's what the statute says. That's what it permits. Typically, and we see this in many, many, many cases.
Testify to the conduct of the activity.
A complaining witness, yes, correct, Your Honor, will testify something happened, XYZ happened. They can do that, and we're not challenging that. She gets to say,
yes,
he took out a gun and followed me around the house and threatened to kill me. All fine. What she cannot do and what it was error for the court to allow is to say, oh, and he got a conviction out of it, second-degree assault conviction.
And he went to prison.
And he went to prison and he was charged. Now, the judge doesn't say she can testify to charges, she can testify to the sentence. But what the judge clearly rules is the conviction can come in. That is the error. And again, that's clear from the ruling. We are not in plain error land.
But you know, Ms. Yauk Erickson, how sometimes witnesses will be given some parameters on their testimony. And then, you know, unbeknownst to counsel or the court, you know, they just go ahead and add. Is that what you think happened here? I mean, the witness herself went on and added this additional testimony.
Perhaps in part. What she may have added is that he was charged, which is obviously inherent in having a conviction,
right,
and that he went to prison.
Right.
What she did not add, what she could have properly been instructed by the prosecutors, that she could say he had a conviction, because that's what the court rules. So again, none of this relates to, we're assessing the legal issue.
Ruling under the statute to say you have a conviction, or should the witness be testifying to the conduct?
Conduct only.
Okay, so when you say she could have properly, maybe that's why I was getting confused, she could have properly said he had a conviction, you think she could have properly said that to be consistent with the court's order,
yes,
but the
I'm
court's
sorry,
order
Honor.
Was error.
Yes,
okay,
absolutely. I don't think the witness was doing anything wrong per se. The witness perhaps blurted out a little more than what the court had intended, but what we are challenging is the error in the ruling, which came far before the testimony, which was it is fine for the complaining witness to say he had a second-degree assault conviction. That is not allowed under the statute.
So the witness testified consistently with the court's order, which
correct,
she said was erroneous.
Correct.
Okay.
Again, there's no plain error here. This is all well litigated. We have a ruling. There's no duty to clarify. It is not that vague.
Well, was there an objection to the court's order and how it described what it was allowing?
Not post the ruling, Your Honor, no. It was the relationship evidence was objected to. They objected to the admission. They argued about it. Then the district court ruled. I don't believe there was any subsequent statement by defense counsel, nor did there have to be. Your ruling that you just made was error. No, we don't have that. But again, plain error is reserved.
It was error because the court referenced you can testify to the conviction.
That is why it was error. Yes.
And you're seeing is under the statute you get to testify to conduct.
Yes.
Not the conviction.
Yes.
It doesn't need to be a conviction.
Absolutely.
Statute.
That happens all the time, right? It
usually isn't.
Right. Where complaining witnesses testify, he attacked me with a shotgun. Even if he wasn't charged or convicted, she can still testify about it.
The difference is that, you know, jurors and everybody else put some extra weight on the fact that there's convictions and prison and sentence, as opposed to the relationship is what do these people seeing and doing to each other.
Absolutely. We have special rules about the admission of prior convictions. They don't come in as relationship evidence. Nothing in the statute suggests that. And the most interesting factual quirk about this case is that these two rulings are very conflicting. So the judge had just said seconds earlier, if you testify, Mr. Rawson, you can only be impeached with an unspecified felony, not the second-degree assault, because that's too prejudicial. The judge had decided telling the jury about a second-degree assault was too prejudicial, and then a second later says, but the witness can testify about it, having to conduct a prejudice analysis to admit it under 634.20. That's very confusing, and in and of itself shows clear error, or error, I should say, on behalf of the court.
So is your argument that relationship evidence, you're saying, is limited only to the witness's testimony, what happened between them? Like, for example, the witness couldn't add anything else to bolster that it was credible. Like, I told people about it, I went to the police and reported it. Because the conviction, arguably, is bolstering the credibility of the of what she says happened between them, right?
Certainly, Your Honor.
So is it the fact that it's a conviction, or can they
yes,
say nothing more to bolster the credibility of that statement?
No, I don't think that's problematic at all, and that's certainly not what we're addressing in this case.
So why not the conviction then?
Because they're special.
Because they're special, because they're introduced, because they're identified in Rule 609 for impeachment
in part,
purposes?
Your Honor, yes, because we have a whole set of law, a whole set of rules about when a jury can hear about a prior conviction. There's a test. The judge has to address it and decide whether or not that's admissible under 609.
If the defendant testifies. But what
correct,
tells us that that's the only way in which it can, I mean, it might come in, obviously they do come in for other purposes when they're predicates for, you know, an enhancement or something like that, right? So, I mean, that's not the only time a conviction comes in. What tells us that it can't come in here?
The statute. So the statute defines the limits of what comes in, right? It's not anything that isn't defined in statute. It's the statute sets the limits of what is allowed in. Domestic conduct. And it lists things that count as domestic conduct.
Do you have a court rule on that's comparable to the relationship statute?
No, it's a statutory evidence provision, Your Honor. There was certainly the case law exception that pre-
had case law, and then we had a statute.
Yes.
I'm always, you know, this intrigues me. I'm probably getting off the point, but I don't know what business the legislature has in adopting rules of evidence. I thought we had a separation of powers that prohibits that. And I know on occasion we've had where the legislature creates a rule and the court accepts it, comedy or whatever, but
certainly.
It becomes the court rule then as opposed to the piece of legislation on any admissibility of evidence.
There's sometimes a confusion because I think both still exist. Sometimes cases reference, we have this case law exception for relationship evidence that didn't go away when the legislature passed the statute. Nonetheless, if you'd like to strike it down, I would welcome that. Nonetheless.
Somebody ought to tell the legislature that we do have a separation of powers and admissibility of evidence is a prerogative of the courts, not the legislature.
Absolutely, Your Honor. So it's actually a nice transition to talk about the cases, and I want to be clear about this. None of the cases cited in respondent's brief hold. A district court is allowed to rule. Prior convictions can come in under Minnesota Statute 634.20. In fact, some of them are quite far afield. So Meldrum is a jury instruction case. It certainly does not uphold the admission of evidence. Barnes-Slater is the closest case. In Barnes-Slater, what's clear is that prior conviction testimony came in as relationship evidence. But what this court addressed was the prejudice prong and said, well, it wasn't that prejudicial because the witness just said this person had a conviction. Never, to my knowledge, has this court held, and certainly in none of respondents' cited cases, is there a holding. Prior convictions can come in as relationship evidence. If this court so holds in this case, I would ask that you publish it because it will be important for practitioners, quite frankly, either way, to know whether or not prior convictions convictions can come in under 634.20.
Is there any case holding that they cannot?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
And certainly there's fair arguments by implication from these cases, but there is no holding to that effect.
And just to circle back to your standard review argument, so your position is this is abuse of discretion. Is that correct?
Correct. The admission of the evidence, and then you review for prejudice. Yes, Your Honor. Plain error is reserved for cases with no objection, and that's certainly not where we are. I think perhaps respondents' quibble is more with my framing of the argument. So you could hold that my stating of the issue was too broad because I also included testimony about charges, testimony about sentence, and that wasn't in the judge's ruling. But even if you conclude that somehow the ruling was the witness can testify that he had a general conviction but not testify about second-degree assault, which the judge didn't say, all of my argument is still intact. Nothing changes. That ruling is still erroneous. It was still a clear ruling. There was no need to renew the objection, and it's still harmful. So even if this court agrees with respondents' sort of construction of the court's argument, we're still not in plain error.
So talk to me. Oh, go ahead.
Do the old cases before the statute give us any help or on this particular subject?
I am not aware of any case under the case law exception or under the statute that holds prior convictions can come in as relationship evidence. I have not found any of those cases. The cases cited by a respondent, some of them are quite unclear. Like, for instance, in Bell, in the fact section, the court says, Mr. Bell has convictions for OFP violations, fact section. But then in the argument, they don't call them convictions, they call them OFP violations. They never say there was testimony about prior convictions. So you can see how the framing of the issue in the opinion is somewhat unclear. There's in facts, there's prior convictions. We don't know that there was testimony about prior convictions. And again, there's certainly no holding. Prior convictions come in as relationship evidence. The last topic I wanted to cover with this court is a bit about remedy and the assertion that if you reverse and remand, you should vacate the entire sort of panoply of the plea agreement. We would ask that you not do that. Of course, Mr. Rawson would prefer a remand with vacation of all of his pleas to nothing. So certainly that would be, I think you have the jurisdiction to do so, but we would ask that you don't. There's some obfuscation about Montermini going on. Montermini is a very particular procedural posture case. So there was Montermini 1, in which this court reversed for withdrawal of some pleas. The district court on remand decided it's appropriate to vacate all these pleas because they all came as a package deal. Then it was appealed a second time, and we get Montermini 2. It is that case that respondent is citing to in which this court holds the district court was fine. What the district court did was fine to vacate all the pleas. That's not where we are. We have no factual determination by a fact finder that these pleas are interrelated. It's a pretty delicate factual issue that can be addressed by the district court should this case be remanded. If this court has no other questions, I would ask that you reverse and remand Mr. Rawson's conviction based on the error in admitting his prior conviction as relationship evidence.
Was it argued in terms of prejudice that conviction is too broad, it's too prejudicial, as opposed to just describing the conduct between the parties?
Yes, absolutely. A defense attorney argued that it was prejudicial to let this evidence in. It may have been a sort of general prejudice argument. I don't know that he said specifically allowing the witness to use the word conviction was prejudicial, but certainly he made a prejudice argument to the district court.
Okay. Anything else, Judge? Okay. You'll have time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Scott Hersey, Special Assistant Isani County Attorney, and I represent the respondent in this appeal. Judge Klopahky, I would first like to address your question about the separation of powers, and I believe the Supreme Court...
I raised it,
Very briefly, the Supreme Court, I believe, dealt with that exact issue after the enactment of the statute. And in State versus McCoy, which I cited in my brief, the Supreme Court stated it would adopt that statute as a rule of evidence as a matter of comity.
Yeah, and it does that every once in a while.
And in this particular case, they did do that.
So then we are talking about it as a court rule.
Exactly.
Even though the statute sets it out.
I believe that's exactly correct, and that has been referenced a number of times in the case law, I believe both from the Supreme Court and from this court. I respectfully disagree with counsel's interpretation, and I cited in my brief the various cases, the Minnesota Supreme Court in Bell, and the Court of Appeals decisions, which were all published in Meyer, Barnslater, and Meldrum. And they basically ruled that it was not an abuse of the district court's discretion to admit evidence of the convictions and the relationship evidence. They didn't distinguish between the two. And it is implicit in all of those rulings that as long as this relationship evidence is coming in, it doesn't appear to matter whether it's coming in as a conviction or whether it is coming in as the actual conduct of the defendant.
Was that a holding in that case, or was that just loose language?
That is the language. You are correct, Judge. I believe it's implicit in the holding that they're not distinguishing between the convictions and the conduct. Because
in this
they
case,
said admission,
pardon me, go ahead and finish here.
Admission of the convictions was held not to be an abuse of discretion.
What kind of conviction was it in that case?
In these various cases, they were all various types of domestic abuse.
The reason I ask, and I don't mean to. I continue.
Sure, review. Finish up.
You know, the statute, which is now the rule, as you've just described it, talks about evidence of domestic conduct. And domestic conduct includes, but is not limited to, evidence of domestic abuse, evidence of it, or a violation of an order for protection, or a harassment restraining order, and a few other specific items. I don't see any reference to convictions. I don't see any reference to sentences. I don't see any references. That's as broad as this case.
That's an excellent point, Judge. But as we just discussed, this is now a rule of evidence adopted by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and they have the right to obviously interpret their rule. Right. And I believe by the decision in Bell and the Court of Appeals decisions in Meyer, Barnslater, and Meldrum, they have interpreted that to make no distinction between the convictions and the actual underlying conduct.
In this case, though, Mr. Hersey, as was pointed out by appellant's counsel, the fact that it came in under 63420 seemed totally inconsistent with the court's ruling with respect to impeachment of Mr. Rawson had he chosen to testify. I mean, the court seemed to be very clear that the second-degree assault conviction, you know, identified would not be coming in. So then, if that's the case, why should it then be put in through this other avenue?
Judge, I would suggest that they're really not inconsistent if one looks at the different tests. You have the one test for 634.20 evidence, which is simply, is the probative value substantially outweighed by the prejudicial nature of it, versus all the Jones factors, all five Jones factors, which you have to go through to decide if something is coming in for impeachment. And as you will note in the transcript, the judge did go through all of the Jones factors on the record and came to the conclusion that they militated in favor of allowing in that conviction for impeachment.
Right, she said identified as felony conviction. Right?
Yes, as a general felony conviction, mm-hmm. she said it could come in. She said it was only the identity of that crime as a second-degree assault mm-hmm. that might have been prejudicial. But those are two different tests.
We're dealing here with the identity of that prior domestic conduct as an offense.
That is true. The judge, and I would ask the court to take a look at the judge's ruling in the motion in limine. The court stated at page 21 of the motion in limine transcript, the court will permit testimony by the complaining witness as it relates to that prior incident and again reference to, in general, to the felony conviction arising out of the incident pursuant to Minnesota Statute 634.20. I think the probative value outweighs the prejudicial effect in this context. I think that's unclear, and I think it was incumbent either at that time or more likely at the time that the victim testified for the defense attorney to object, because by objecting, once the witness had blurted out that he was convicted, he went to prison, he was convicted of second-degree assault, if there had been an objection, the trial court could have addressed it. One, the trial court could have clarified what her original ruling was, but second, if in fact she did not intend for this conviction to come in as a second-degree assault, she could have remedied it right there. She could have said, I'm instructing the jury to disregard that. That's stricken from the record. There'll be no further mention of that. And it could have been remedied at that point. And that's why the state believes that the original ruling was unclear. It was not a definitive ruling. And that should have been clarified by the defense, and they should have made an objection at trial. And that is why the state believes that this should be a plain error review. But in any event, whichever standard you use, whether it's plain error or whether it's abuse of discretion, I would respectfully submit that there is not prejudicial error here.
So it's your relative to the standard of review for a moment before you turn to prejudice. So it's the state's view that the court might have meant that the conviction should not come in unless the defendant testified. Is that correct?
The ruling, as I understood it, is that the victim could testify regarding the domestic conduct using the probative prejudicial weighing test. And I believe, although it's not clear, that the court was saying that a general conviction could come in through that victim.
Right. But okay, so the state's position is that the court's order was that the testifying victim could testify to a conviction.
That is what I'm presuming, Judge. I'm not absolutely positive, and that's why I think there should have been an objection at that point. But I would submit that this was not prejudicial. We have the factors, as we indicated, from the Matthews case, both parties, I believe, relied upon that. The way in which this was presented, this basically popped out of the witness's mouth. The prosecutor asked her when that prior incident had happened, and that's when she popped out with the information about he was arrested, he was convicted, he went to prison on a second-degree assault. It was inadvertent, and that was rather a passing reference. I don't think it was highly persuasive. The information that was persuasive was the nature of the underlying conduct. The fact that it was a general conviction was briefly mentioned by the prosecutor in closing.
What does simply referencing a second-degree assault conviction show us about the relationship of the parties? Because there are various ways of committing second-degree assault. It could be harm, it could be a threat, and probably needs a firearm. But the jury does know all of this?
It the jury doesn't need to know the details of a second-degree assault, but they didn't in any event.
But
it was
without
just...
Without knowing the detail, how does it explain the relationship between the parties?
Well...
That's the whole purpose of having evidence of this kind of conduct, isn't it?
I would submit that the courts have treated the conviction and the underlying conduct basically the same. And since we're talking about a rule of evidence, I think the Supreme Court has the right to determine how broad
this is. Which Supreme Court decision do you think is most on point on this subject?
On this subject, I think Bell is. And I think in addition to Bell, we have decisions of this court, which I cited in Meyer, Barnes, Slater, and Meldrum.
Just on Supreme Court at the moment. You say, I mean, since now it is the Supreme Court's rule, I want to see what the Supreme Court said about its rule.
Okay.
Bell, you say what else?
Bell was the only Supreme Court decision that I discovered in my research on this topic, Judge.
And tell me what the facts were in Bell again, and what was testified to that.
One would have to go back to the exact language, Judge, but my recollection is that the Supreme Court did not distinguish between the conduct and the convictions. They were prior, I believe they were domestic assault convictions, if I remember correctly, in that particular case. But they did not distinguish between the two. The objection was to have the convictions come in and the related conduct. And the Supreme Court said it was not an abuse of discretion for the district court to allow that in. So I would submit, number one, there isn't an error here. Number two, I would submit that if there was, it was harmless under the Matthews test. It wasn't highly persuasive. It was only briefly mentioned in closing argument. And the defense attorney effectively countered that. The defense attorney's strategy was to point out, and in fact, he elicited information about the conviction and the prison term, to point out that the victim maintained contact with Mr. Rawson while he was in prison. The relationship was reinitiated after Mr. Rawson got out of prison, and they maintained that relationship up until December 29th, when the victim terminated the relationship. And additionally, in weighing any potential harm in this case to determine whether it's prejudicial, the evidence was strong. The victim reported clearly to her friend within a day or so of the actual sexual assault. She didn't report then, but she did report 4 days later when she was at the hospital. Her statements were consistent to the police, and the DNA evidence corroborated her as well. So I would submit that under the Matthews test, there is no prejudice, and that the courts have basically treated the convictions and the underlying conduct the same. And I would submit the convictions under Rule 609 may come in for impeachment. But here, we're not talking about impeaching anyone with this conviction because Mr. Rawson did not testify. We're talking about the introduction of this as part of the relationship evidence. And I would submit in this particular case, there was an error, but if there was any error, it was harmless beyond reasonable doubt.
Can I ask a question about the standard the test for harmlessness? And that's when we were looking at the case law, I mean, there's case law that's specific to prejudice in the realm of 634.20 and as well as prior bad acts. Like there's a Benton decision at the Supreme Court from 2015 that lays out different factors from Matthews. It talks about whether the state presented other evidence, whether there was an appropriate limiting instruction, whether the state dwelled on it, and whether the evidence was overwhelming. There are different factors in Matthews. I know you both briefed Matthews, but I wondered whether there was a reason that Benton, another Supreme Court decision from 2015, which was exactly on the topic of relationship evidence, is not the standard, if you had a perspective on that. And maybe it's not something you considered, but since we did, I wanted you to...
I would submit that the tests are slightly different, but I don't think they're significantly different. Essentially, it seems like they look at the totality of all of the circumstances in the case, such as the fact of how the conviction came out. Here it was inadvertent. Whether it was a brief reference, and here it was. Whether the court gave a cautionary instruction, and here the court gave four cautionary instructions. One, right before the victim testified to this, each time the victim's statement was played, and then again in the court's final instructions. And that was to be assured that the jury did not use the evidence improperly. So I would submit that under either test, it is satisfied that there is harmless error.
You mentioned the cases from this court and the Supreme Court. You mentioned Bell and others. Did any of those cases specifically involve reference to a penalty? That's one of the objections made here.
Yes, and I can say, and I cannot recall distinctly which one or ones mentioned the penalty, but there was mention by, I believe, the victim in those cases that the person was convicted and went to jail or something of that nature. Received a penalty, whatever it was, but I believe there was, in fact, a reference to
the case that was?
I don't, Judge. I think that would have been one of the three cases from this court.
Okay.
And if there are no further questions, I will conclude by asking the court to deny the request for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Counsel referenced those cases from this court and the Bell case from the Supreme Court. Did any of those cases, in your recollection, involve reference to a sentence?
Not that I recall, Your Honor. I'm not going to affirmatively say they don't because they
well,
might.
That's one of your objections, isn't it?
Absolutely. My objection is that none of those cases held what respondent says they do. So here's what's interesting. Neither in respondent's brief nor before this court has the state of Minnesota offered any substantive reason that prior convictions are admissible under 634.20. Why they count as domestic conduct. As I understand respondents' argument, it is cases have said this. That's fine. So then we need to go look at those cases and see if that's true. It's not. He says they are implicit holdings. That means there is no holding. None of those cases say prior convictions come in under this statute.
Is sentence, I hate to spend all our time on this, but is the sentence aspect of it a plain error issue as opposed to the conviction?
Perhaps, Your okay. Honor. I mean, that's possible. Nonetheless, for sure, the judge says, I mean, the language was the felony conviction arising out of the behavior comes in as relationship evidence. To be sure, that part of my argument is intact. That is not reviewed for plain error because that's what the judge ruled. So if anyone is misunderstanding the record, it's me as appellate counsel. There was no reason for trial counsel to renew his objection because he understood it. He understood the court's ruling. Whatever was going on in the courtroom.
There's a conflation here between what the judge allowed and what the witness said, but you seem not to be objecting to what the witness said that went beyond what the judge allowed.
Well, I didn't raise it as an independent issue. For instance, I did not say her blurts were so prejudicial that this court should reverse. I didn't say it was ineffective assistance not to object. To be sure, Your Honor. As you know, the way I raised the issue in my principal brief was all of that testimony was error and violated the court's order. If you disagree, if you believe the court's order was limited to conviction, which is a reasonable interpretation of that statement by the court, nonetheless, I objected to the testimony about conviction, the court ruled about conviction, that certainly is not plain error. It would be completely unfair to rule that where there was an objection, it was litigated, there is a ruling, no one in the courtroom seemed to misunderstand it, that defense counsel needs to re-object in the middle of testimony to preserve it for appeal. That is not the law.
Could you speak to the prejudice?
Certainly, Your Honor. So whichever test is used, there are a few facts that are helpful to Mr. Rawson. It's referenced by the prosecutor in closing. Now, he didn't repeat it over and over and over again. Nonetheless, he referenced it in closing. I do not agree that this testimony was inadvertent. It was brief. The witness did not belabor the fact. Nonetheless, she said he was convicted and went to prison and talked about how he spent some time in prison. The fact that it came from the witness during live testimony is more compelling to a jury than if, for instance, there were documents presented. That makes the evidence more prejudicial because it came through her words. And
I believe... The conviction part of it? Just that she says there was a conviction is more prejudicial than if they actually had the document saying, here's the conviction?
I think so, Your Honor. I think juries pay far more attention to people talking on the stand than a document that comes before them that has all sorts of different words on it, one of which happens to be, he has a conviction. You can disagree, but I think certainly when jurors hear something from this woman who's talking about, he took out a shotgun and followed me around the house and threatened me, that's compelling.
Well,
I would hope
that a jury would find a court order for a conviction and a sentence compelling as well.
Yes. Well, she could talk about what he did. That's, you're not challenging that.
No, okay. But again, when she says one breath later, and he was convicted and he went to prison, and, you know, that's the same testimony. So if they're paying attention to one, they're paying attention to the other. And I certainly don't mean to suggest that juries are disregarding exhibits in the sense that we're assessing prejudice and how prejudicial is it. Live testimony is prejudicial. So to the extent it's error, that matters, that it's prejudicial. If this court has no further questions, I would ask that you reverse Mr. Rawson's conviction and remand. Thank you very much.
Thank you both. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time frame.